After all you put me through, you think I despise you. But in the end, I want to thank you, because you made me that much stronger. When I thought I
knew you again. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. This is Melissa Peskin. This is podcast episode number 4. I am so happy and privileged and excited to have my two of my favorite seniors. I guess I call you my seniors because I was a first year when you guys were a 3. So this is Dr. Kathleen Morrell and Dr. Tamar Goldwasser. And I'll let you introduce yourself. But anyway, go ahead. Kathleen, tell me where you are now and like your trajectory.
Sure. So I'm currently the Associate Chair of Education and the Director of Family Planning and the Residency Program Director at Maimonides in Brooklyn. After residency at Einstein, which we're going to delve into today, I did my fellowship in complex family planning at Columbia, stayed there as a family planning attending for a couple of years, and then I did a non-clinical fellowship in reproductive health advocacy at Physicians for Reproductive Health, and now I've been at Maimonides for 10 years, which is literally the longest place I have ever been anywhere in my life because I'm a military brat, so I've never been anywhere for 10 years before.
But now you are.
Yeah.
What does that feel like?
Weird. like an itch that needs to be scratched. It's very strange, but I'm happy in my job. So it's kind of like a weird thing to, for my brain to wrap it around.
Happiness. What is that? That is awesome. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Tamar, you were my senior for the better part of residency. And thank God.
Hi. So I did residency with you guys and OBGYN. And then after that, I did actually a second residency in medical genetics, and I stayed at Montefiore for that. And then I worked at Montefiore for maybe 7 years as an attending doing reproductive genetics, labor floor, teaching medical students. And now I'm in a private practice that puts me in a hospital setting where I do mostly reproductive genetics in a fetal ultrasound unit. And then I do fetal diagnosis with amniocentesis and CVS. And also, I am the medical director of cancer genetics at Englewood Health in New Jersey.
That is amazing. Wow. Look at you guys. You're so awesome. And I met you and I knew you back when I thought you guys were celebrities, you were superstars. Everything you did was so incredible from the vantage point of someone who comes in, like not knowing what a cervix feels like, seeing you capable people really able to do honestly anything or everything. At the time, I'll never forget that feeling.
It's fun to talk about this right now because my new interns show up on campus on Thursday. And I like the people who are becoming their chiefs. I'm like, do you remember when you guys started and you saw the chiefs on the labor floor the first time and you were like, whoa, they're like the smartest human beings and they like handle everything. I was like, in 4 days, someone's going to feel that way about you. Like, isn't that cool?
I'm so good, Kathleen, as an attending to bring that back because it's good to have those memories. I think that some of us keep those memories fresh and alive and we remember what it felt like in the different stages. And I think that's what makes for a good teacher and someone to look out for new learners and to watch them go through the steps. So I think that that's awesome that you bring that. I mean, I remember thinking that our chief, Leo Pevsner, was like, magical because when I was an intern, I would go and do a delivery. And when I came out, he had done everything that I was supposed to do.
Yep.
And more. So yeah. Like triage is now cleared out and I've, checked all the patients on the labor floor and you can just take your time and write your delivery note and birth certificate. And I just was like, how? Like, wow. You know?
Yeah. And by hand, by the way.
Yeah. Right?
Note by hand.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And like Kathleen, I don't know, you used to, especially at Jacoby, this was definitely like a magic at Jacoby. It's definitely a magic trick for sure. Right. Cause we'd be like in a separate unit. It was just us in triage. We really thought that we had the world on our shoulder, right? We had to do triage and we come to you to present and you secretly knew everything about the patient already. And I don't know how you did that with like the primitive computer system, but you knew everything. So you're just like crossed, hands crossed, just like like shaking nodding. Your head, nodding your head and waiting. And you're like, and what about this? And what about her asthma attack? And what about the steroids and the intubation that she had? And what about, you know, and you're like, I didn't know she had asthma, you know, or like on the Weiler labor floor, you're just like, you know, you have to do a section. And you're just like shaking your head and like nodding. You're like, make it happen, Melissa. Just make it happen. And you're like, okay, I'm trying.
Like name Tim Gunn, make it work.
Yeah, make it work.
Just make it work.
Yeah. So tomorrow, I mean, you, I spent so much of my first year with you. And I think one of the things that sticks out of my head is we did GYN and then we went to GYN Onc together.
Yes.
But on GYN, you went and you probably don't remember this, but you sort of like saw the ER as in a completely different light than I think anyone has ever seen the ER in past, present, future residency.
I mean, that's a Tamar gift about most things in life.
Right. Well, fair. And you just like, were like, it is such a privilege to take care of people. I think I actually referenced you in the last podcast episode. Cause like you just like framed it completely differently. And I was like, excuse me. Okay. But you, there was this woman and she had a 16-week loss and you just sort of like so gingerly caught this fetus. And the way that you handled her and with empathy and compassion and sort of delivered the pregnancy and just so gentle. And I just watched you and I just, in that moment, I was just sort of completely in awe. Is you were just so gentle with the whole process. And the room was obviously somber and it was very delicate. And you just handled it like such a pro. I don't really, with your class specifically, I don't actually remember interacting with any attending. I just remember you guys.
Yeah.
And you just did this and you just like sort of afterwards gave me probably some sage wisdom and advice and told me to put orders in and onward with the next consult, you know?
I mean, that's what was so hard about the residency, like challenging, because you're dealing with the most delicate, sensitive, intimate moments in a person's life. And yet, in another sense, it's your job, right? So you have to just like check it off, make sure it's all tied up and then move on, which is very hard, you know, because you're not there as their friend. You're not there as their like aunt or parent. You're just there in that moment. And you're in our residency, you were probably never going to see them again, right? So it was just a one-time moment. You had to quickly gain their trust, do what needed to be done, and then move on. So I think emotionally there were like, you had to like turn things on and turn things off. But, you know, I remember the first time delivering a miscarriage like that. And I remember it was very hard for me, like inside it was so hard. It was so sad. And like, I felt, I didn't even like the feeling of doing the delivery. It felt awful. And then, but then I'm like, but this is much more awful for her. And so I'm going to be here for you. But I remember it was really hard.
Were you just made that way? Or is that something that somebody taught you?
I think
it's like a lesson. I don't know if it can be taught, but it's definitely something I think that's really important for trainees. No.
I mean, I went into OBGYN because I wanted to go into women's health. That was my initial inspiration. And my main identifying persona for a long time was that I'm a big sister. Like, that is who I am. I'm a big sister. So I want to take care of young women, older women. I want to make sure that they're safe and understand things. And so my focus was always on the woman. I mean, always, 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 always.
Yeah. And that definitely rings true. That's not just you saying that. But I think, you know, I think our field in particular, and this is the hard thing. It's one of the things about OBGYN that I don't think that you'll know how you react. Like, it's kind of one of those things you have to be in it to know how you experience it. But it does require some emotional distancing in order to get through it. Because you'll have a shift where you can deal with like a screaming patient who you have to like talk through the fact that you're about to like do a stat C-section on her and then maybe deal with a miscarriage patient or an angry patient who can't get her epidural, all within the matter of like a 2-hour stretch of your 12-hour shift, right? And so it's like there has to be some understanding that like you do have a certain amount of empathy coins every day, and sometimes they get spent. And so that's something that you have to like forgive yourself sometimes too, because the residency part is just so physically and emotionally exhausting on you on like a day by day drudge that like I feel much, I can easily, my empathy bank is like, I can fill it up a lot quicker as an attending than I could as a resident. As a resident, it was like constantly running on empty. So it was harder, but you need, I needed personally, and it sounds like Tamar probably does some of this too, but I've always been someone who, I never wear scrubs to the work, to the job. Even when I was a resident, I always came in something else and changed into my scrubs. And then I always change out of my scrubs when I leave. And that has been a part of my like emotional and mental changeover to like, now I'm at work like now. And then when I leave, I'm like, I'm not at work anymore. I'm Kathleen and I'm just on the subway with everybody else. And that's just what I'm doing now. And it allows me mentally to like decompress from the job and leave it there.
Yeah. I think it took me a while to learn that, to figure that out. Cause I was so open and like, didn't even realize what it would like, what it would do. But I don't even know if I learned to do that until after residency. You know, I never really wanted to even leave the hospital.
Cause you wanted to check in on everybody.
Check in, make sure everything is okay. And people used to yell at me, go home. And then when I started dating Ezra, it was the first time I was like, oh, I want to go, but I want to stay. Oh, this is what it's like to feel like you have another thing you want to go to. And that was a very strange thing for me, because the first 2 years or more, I was just like fully all in and I didn't need to leave.
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't even think about that aspect of it. That definitely adds complexity. You know, Kathleen, what you were saying is actually something my boxing trainer teaches me, where if I'm having a bad day, he's just like outlines the sort of the frame of a window or a door. And he's like, okay, just step right in, leave whatever was out there. And now you're here because we're going to get into it. And I didn't even like really equate the clothes changing, but that makes so much more sense. I think that probably helped you a lot. I did not have that foresight. I just like rolled out of bed and like, and just had to get to the hospital.
People, it was an efficiency thing. And for me, it was a purposefully mental thing. I mean, but I could, you know, I could go from like alarm to stepping in to Weiler, like 35 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah. I lived on the east side. So I got it down to like a good 12 minutes from wake up to out of the house.
Wow.
That's impressive.
Do you know that? So I tend to just run late. Like that's my.
No.
Really? Yeah. Really? We didn't know. I don't know if the podcast can tell the sarcasm in my voice, but it's there.
But I don't know. As I think that based on how late I run, I did pretty well in residency. I was.
Yeah.
So
it was only social things you were. Right,
exactly. Cause that was the real me. But like, to get to work on time, I had to wait. I had to leave 2 hours. I had to set my alarm 2 hours early.
Yeah.
So that I could get there. And I knew if I turn my car on before 6 a.m., I'll be there early. And if I turn the car on after 6 a.m., I'm late. You know, so like.
I still have vivid memories of the one time, because my phone alarm and when you called me was the same ring.
Oh.
On my flip phone. that my patients made fun of me for years about while it sat on my hip. But so the one time I slept through my alarm or didn't set my alarm in residency, the one time when I was an intern on ONC, and it wasn't Lisa Simmons. And she called me and I realized it was my phone ringing and not the alarm. And I picked it up. And then she just very kindly was like, you just missed work. You're just waking up. You must have forgotten to set your alarm. Take a deep breath.
Oh.
Wake up, drive safely, and just get here when you can get here. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. You can hear it in my voice. Oh. I was like losing my shit on the other end of the phone. And I was just like, oh my God. And she was like, it's okay. Just drive safely. Everything's fine. Oh, just get here.
Maybe. And I, like, maybe that's because we've literally all been there, right? So she wanted someone who may or may not have said that to her.
Yeah.
Because that is absolutely beautiful. That takes a unique person. I didn't know her, but that kind of is awesome, right? Yeah. Knowing that you are going to flip your shit. You're going to just like, no teeth brushing, nothing. You're just like, and you're going to drive 90 miles an hour to work, you know?
Put your life in danger while you freak right out driving up to the Bronx. Yeah.
No, she was really cool. She used to like, I remember she would talk me through a delivery and she was like pretty relaxed, like an attending, you know, like more like someone who knew. And she said, listen, a good baby can sometimes look bad, but a baby who's not well can never look good. So
I say that all the time. And someone must have told me that.
Told you because I loved it. And then I told you.
Might have gotten passed down the Monty ways.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I have a story like that, Kathleen, but it was when I was late on GYN. Sophia Palmer was my third, and I was with her for most of the year. So I knew I needed to, like, you know, make it work. And she was like tough and she was scary. And I was like, well, this is going to work. So anyway, she said, come to work tomorrow at 7. So I get off the elevator on that floor at 7 and I have a coat and I'm holding my bag. And there she is already with the chart open at the nurse's station charting. And she looked at me and she's like, you're late. So then I remember saying to myself, okay, 7 means 6:45. That's it. I mean, but she said it to me and I think it was very good. Like I didn't think it was mean. She just said, she looked at me, she said, you're late. And then I got it. And that was it. You know, I thought, why not? Like I'll do what you need me to do. So
that actually is a nice opening into this other story, which I know you know and know you remember. And we were on Ankh, and Ankh was really hard. And I had a husband that I felt like I needed to get home to. And I wanted to leave the hospital. And that was not a secret. As anyone who knows me, every single emotion is written like freaking bold, highlighted on my face. So you're sitting there at the computer and you're like, Melissa, I need you to go upstairs and check all the social work notes. And I'm looking at my watch and it's like 6:15. And I was like, and I think I rolled my eyes at you.
For sure you did.
And you're like, excuse me, Melissa, you can't do that. You have, like, I'm telling you what to do. This is a part of your job. You just have to go and do it. I said, Tamar, you know I'm going to do it. Do you want me to roll my eyes in front of you or outside the room? They're going to get rolled. I'm going to go do it. But, like, you got to know how I feel about it. Because it's going to... And you're like, okay. And you're very understanding, but you, like, laid down the law.
I mean, I think I could... I know Kathleen literally is like a military woman, but I think I could have done something like that. Like, I think if it was for this cause of like learning all the aspects of being an OBGYN, like, I don't know, I guess you could have told me what to do, but then it's true. Once I wanted to leave in the later years, it was different. So I feel for you. But I remember thinking like, what is up with this girl? She comes in, her hair's a mess. She's half asleep. And like, get it together. We are here. We are working. Like it starts right away. Like there's no wake up period when you're here. And I remember saying to you, I know it's late, but I'm here with you. We're doing it together. Yeah. Remember?
You did say that.
Like, we're doing it together. I'm not telling you to stay by yourself. But in the end, I ended up feeling like you were my sister.
Absolutely.
In a good way. Yeah.
You know, Tamar, hearing you say, who is this like girl who didn't brush her hair? And like, you know, I didn't see myself like that, but I'm glad you said that. I want to hear more about what that was like to see somebody roll their eyes at you when you ask them to do something. Like,
I was just like, what? We're working now.
What
like,
the fuck?
Turn on. What's with this attitude?
Mode? Yeah. Like,
yeah, but like, can I just paint a picture of what it meant to go and look at all the social work notes, you're talking about like a patient census of possibly like 17 people. And the notes are not electronic. You have to go into the chart and then you have to go and flip through every single piece of paper until you find the most current social work note.
And the most and read through it to find out what's the half a sentence that you need to actually take from that social work note. Most of it you didn't need to know. So you had to scan the whole thing to try to figure out like what's the punchline of it's this note.
I mean, it's a lot. It's crazy.
Because social work notes are like stories.
No, they are. And then at the very, very end, it's like safe discharge.
She's fine.
Basically, we needed to know, are you going home or are you not going home?
Subacute nursing facility.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's hard.
Sniff. When I first learned the term sniff. I was like, why does everyone keep talking about sniffing? I don't get this.
What's that? I don't even know what that is.
Subacute nursing facility. SNF.
Oh, I missed that.
Right?
Well, then the next time this happened, you're in the OR and I was checking in and I, you know, as all of us used to do, right? We were supposed to check in the OR because you guys would be in the OR the whole time. And so I went to go check on you and we had this very special patient. I guess I can't say her name, but anyway, I remember her name. But there's a very special patient who had been on for a really long time and she was finally going to go home. Finally, like it was a long time. And actually she left in the most dramatic fashion. But prior to leaving, like either the day of or the day before, I go to check in and I was like, okay, so Miss, you know, so-and-so is ready to leave. She's literally wants to get out the door. Is that we're discharge is on the plate. And you said, but you need to go ask her if she wants home nursing. And I said, please don't make me ask her. I'm begging you, please. I don't want to go back in that room. And you're like, Melissa, we ask everybody if they need home nursing. And if we need to set it up, she needs to stay a little longer so that we get that, you know, right. Because anyone who needs home nursing is going to get home nursing. And I was like, you know, thinking everything is dying. I'm just like, I trudge back upstairs and I slowly like open the door and I look inside and I'm like, do you want to like get out? And so I was like, nope, she didn't want home nursing. So.
That was a no.
That was definitely
a no. Answer received.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I was so annoying.
You were very thorough, which is good. And you had high expectations. And honestly, as far as my, how I am an attending now, I don't think there's anything wrong with high expectations. It just doesn't fall as well on the.
Oh my God.
Tamar said that she knew what she was getting into. I chose Einstein because I wanted to be at a place like Einstein. Melissa, did you have an idea of what you were getting into?
Not really.
That makes a lot of sense, right?
Makes total sense.
So I was coming from Albany Med and I had been engaged and was about to marry Eric. And Eric was from the city and he worked at in Queens at a school in Queens. And so I did everything I could to like come to New York. And of all the programs in New York, this was the closest to my experience in Africa. And I just wanted to work with a vulnerable patient population because I was so like my time in that I spent in Ghana for a year just like really was like such a heavy influence in my life. So I just wanted to be in a place like that. And of all of the
programs like Flushing or Jamaica then.
Well, but I don't know. There was something about Albert Einstein and I had interviewed as a medical student actually. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so I wanted to go sort of just to go, but I had no idea about what was in store. So when I went to my second look, Tal was there and he has like 6 pagers on his belt. Okay. And he goes,
Tal's pants never fell down.
He's a little
tall, like really, he always had them on tight so that the 6 pagers wouldn't make your pants fall.
Yeah. It was pretty impressive. And he goes to me, he goes, so, you want to come to residency here? Yeah. And I was like, you know, I was like bright eyed and bushy tailed. I really did. Of course, I really had no idea what was in store for me. And he goes, he takes all of the pagers. And mind you, I'm just a medical student. Second look, takes all the pagers off his belt and he hands them to me. And I'm like, he's like, welcome to residency. I looked down at these pagers and I was like, oh, okay. Oh my God.
When he was an intern, he was our intern. So he was a year behind us. He said to me, he goes, every day is like my first day in America. Like, you tell me to draw blood. Okay, I'll do it. But I don't know what I need. And if you tell me what I need, I don't know what that looks like. And if I know what it looks like, I don't know where to find it. And he's like, every day here, he's like, is literally like, I just like got off the boat from Israel. And then he said it was harder than the army. He did say that more than once.
I think the army is a little bit easier for some people in terms of like, they're very clear on expectations and you know exactly what to expect and you know exactly what they want from you. And then you just do it.
Yeah, I guess so.
I feel like sometimes in residency in particular, you'll have some people you work with who are like that and other people where you're like, I think you need me to read your mind. And that's going to be really hard for me to actually do what you want me to do if you don't actually tell me what it is that you want me to do.
And it's because not every doctor is good at expressing that.
Right. But they'll tell you when they did it the way they don't like it. And you're like, well, I would have done it the right way if you just told me in the first place the way you wanted it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a complete frustration of residency when you work with a ton of attendings.
Oh, yeah.
Three different hospitals like us. But I also, there's so many things about residency that like, we talk about loving it now, but we didn't love every day and we didn't love every minute. Right. And we had people that we worked under who were like, you're going to look back on it fondly. And we were like, fuck you. There's no way we're ever going to say that. And then here we are, like, we get together like war buddies and we talk about it and we laugh and we drink and we love it. We love talking about it just like old war buddies. And it really is because we understand the point of it. And I think that the hard times were hard, but that was okay. And it almost, we all, the type of people that we are, we felt like it needed to be hard. Cause if it was easy, then everybody would just do it. But we have the privilege of actually being able to.
So did Christina Aguilera tap into that mentality or not with her song Fighter?
Kathleen, like meeting you set such a high bar, right? So I met you right away, like immediately. I think we signed out to each other in the first or second rotation. And I was just like, I need to be good enough for you. Like, forget the chiefs and the attendings. Like, I felt like I needed to be good enough for you. You impressed me so much with your like clarity of thinking and, you know, like, organization and just like can do. I mean, and just, you were just so put together and professional and you impressed the socks out of me. And I remember you once, you straightened my collar sometimes and you're like, come on, smarten up tomorrow. You got to put your, you know, and so you really inspired me. And also Lisa, we were just talking about Lisa. I remember just thinking, oh my God, I'm with such great people and I want to be like, as good as them. And so it made it more worthwhile. You know, it made it inspiring. You know, you guys were.
Our class had a bunch of personalities in it. I love our class.
Oh, totally, totally.
Very strong personalities. And, yeah. But you guys were really universally so good at what you did. And I don't know, you had one, you had Dave, right? Dave was the only boy, right?
The Eldar.
Yeah, for 1 year.
Yeah, he was our prelim.
Oh, I didn't meet him. But, I mean, Dave is maybe the funniest person on the planet and, you know, was a really actually perfect mix for you guys. But you as women just were all so strong and capable and smart. And
he's the perfect match to go along with us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know. I didn't get an ego from him. I mean, you knew him differently, but he was just funny. He just had to, like, figure out the good in and the funny joke in everything.
We were always telling him to go home.
Right.
You stick around and do the intern's job, then we have to do that. Don't stop setting an example for them that we're going to do that for them, because we're not. So go home.
He was hilarious. He was so funny. I would have never thought to like play a prank on the coming in team, but he sometimes wrote a whole fake labor floor board for the incoming team, and they would like just look at it and be
everyone's on heparin and insulin drips, and there were some ruptured uteruses and like some five previous sections who were laboring and. Yeah.
He must have invented that then, if that was his thing, because we carry that on. Anytime we won the board at night, we would do a fake board.
Yeah, I think he was the first one to do it. I don't think any of our seniors had done it before.
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know what a fake board is, this is an example of the legacy that Dave Lubell left behind. And then we'll get back to our regular podcast.
We've been trying to reach the Cell Saver people all day. It's just really, something's going on in the hospital.
Oh my God. Our next patient is 39, pair 0, 29 and 4. She actually is really interesting. What? Yeah, she has a history of stage 1B1 cervical cancer and had a rad hist and actually got one of the first uterine transplants in the country and is pregnant via IVF. She has a low-lying placenta. She's in testing for severe IUGR and was sent up for prolonged monitoring due to like a kind of shitty-looking tracing and whole variability with some like big whopping variable B cells. The Dopplers were actually normal today in spite of this, so there's like no delivery plan at present since being here. She has mostly just had minimal variability and just like a couple of random B cells every 30 minutes or so. She's not contracting.
I'll be right back. I'm gonna put this.
The placenta is low lying, but it's about 1.5 centimeters from the internal os, and there's no evidence of abruption at this point. So we are just planning to monitor her. MFM is aware of her, and they sent her in. We're holding off on beta for now, and hopefully, you know, if her tracing kind of stays status quo, we may be able to ship her to Anti and do BID, NSTs and daily BPPs on her. Next patient is a 24. So it's actually, she'd be for section and you're going to have to call in onc, unfortunately, because of her surgical history.
Well, she doesn't have a cervix, so we can't do a cervical exam.
The next patient is a 24-year-old P011 at 26 and 2, who came in
P-prom. But Kathleen, do you remember the drug mule?
Oh my God, yes.
Can you tell?
I don't think I'm going to remember all the details of the story, to be honest. You're going to have to tell it.
I mean, it's mostly, so he, I wasn't there, but I came after, I guess immediately after, and it just was the talk of from everybody. But basically, I think he made the fake board and he said there was someone from Colombia and she was a drug mule and she was like preterm and she was abrupting and all this stuff. And you're like, why is she still pregnant? And he goes, well, they didn't want to section her because she's worth a lot of money. Like she had a lot of cocaine in her that she had swallowed.
Oh my God. I mean,
me taking it seriously though. And asking actual questions like, well, has she absorbed any into her system? What are her vital signs?
Oh my God. We saw a fair share of people who were cocaine users and were in labor or pregnant.
You saw her fair share of literally everything.
Yeah. I went into Einstein because I heard it was the hardest, most intense training program in New York. But I didn't actually consider who the patients were going to be. That it wasn't on my radar. Okay. But then, I mean, it was so compelling. I'm like, oh my God, we need to be here because these patients really need us. Like, I used to call my mother on drives home and say, Mom, I mean, she doesn't have anyone to go home to. And like, you know, we had a good talk, but what's going to happen to her tomorrow? And, you know, I just felt like we needed to be there so badly. But Melissa, like, I didn't realize that was going to be a draw, but in the end, I'm so grateful. And I got to see so many slices of humanity that I didn't realize I needed to see. And, you know, so glad that I was there. And, I mean, we saw a lot of really sad things too. We saw a lot of people who had very, very little, like financially, very little family support, very little access to like continuous good health care. And it was very sad. I mean, I just was horrified that in the Bronx, there's no good public transportation. Like, they can't even get to an appointment in a normal way. You have to take 3 buses and then walk across 2 highways just to get to your appointment. Plus, you're taking your kids with you because you don't have a babysitter and it's not safe to leave the kids because it's not a safe neighborhood. So that just, it made it real. Like, this is why the Bronx has a lot of, you know, just so many needs. It was moving.
I mean, I think training in a place like Einstein, it trains you to go anywhere, right? Because but it's not just the medicine part. It's the like, can you deal with the hard stuff that being an OBGYN actually is going to happen again, right? Like, bad things happen in our field. We have the happiest and the saddest floor at any given day, right? Like, because the bad things that happen are really bad. And so I do think that you can't train people to handle that, but you get we got a good chunk of that at Einstein. Like, we saw it all literally and included all the bad stuff too, which I think is necessary, like, to make sure that you can handle it and that this is what you want to do for a living, because it's part of the job.
Yeah, it definitely trains you to the T, and it's, you know, I think it's life-changing, just all those interactions with all those people that you probably otherwise would never have crossed paths with.
Right. Like, I'm going through people's pocketbooks, right? Like, if someone was coming in labor and we wanted to know some of her medical history and it was somewhere in her bag, but the bag had all of her life belongings also. And I'm sitting there going through the bag and we're reading it together when we're organizing the papers. And, you know, like, that's very intimate. That's, you know, it makes you really, I mean, you just appreciate every single thing that you have also when you realize what people are dealing with. And, you know, they're just trying to have a baby and they have to bring all their belongings with them. So that, I mean, I'm so happy I came to Einstein. I mean, I didn't realize I was coming for that, but that was a big, big, big part.
I think it's really, so one of the things, because now I've been program director for 7 years. So this is like, I've been through 8 interview cycles now. And I think starting on like cycle 2 or 3, when we started to do all virtual interviews, I made sure, because one of the residents was like, I remember you said this on interview day. And I was so happy you did. And I was like, oh God, what BS came out of my mouth that like you like hung on to? And she was like, that you said it was really hard. And that if you didn't want it to be hard, don't come here.
Oh, wow.
You and say that.
I do. I say it now every time, because there are easier residencies. Like, right. You don't have to train at a safety net hospital in immigrant central New York with diversity on steroids. You don't.
Right.
There are other places where you might have other people move your patients and draw blood and remove Foley's, and you might be able to sit around and study for your boards. This is not that residency.
Right.
So you have to be honest with yourself, so that you spend the next 4 years training in a place that doesn't like beat you down on a daily basis, because this is that residency. So if you're down with that, come. And if you're not down with that, then do yourself a favor and don't come here.
That is so you to say.
Yeah.
That. I love that. You don't beat around the bush. I, you know, what's so funny is that we didn't have any time to study, right? Like, we had no downtime, except we did have didactics. We had stats, and stats is so funny because not every place has.
Johnny.
And Tajani rounds and Shazat rounds, right? Morning.
Goldberg. Goldberg.
And Goldberg rounds and chief, the chairman rounds, right? All these rounds. And like, you had to prepare, whether you slept or not, you had to prepare, you had to read, you had to be up to date. So we didn't really have like formal, in a way, formal learning so much, but we did have this, you're the grind, so that you didn't feel like a total idiot when someone so incredible and magical as Dr. Tajani asked you a question and you so badly want to get it right. So that you see that like little twinkle in her eye that she's proud of you. Yeah. Right.
I mean, standing there for stats is really daunting. I mean, right. You're going over all the guidelines for like every single issue that came up on your case list. And you're probably going to get 4 hours of sleep maximum beforehand. And you have to be there early and you got to be ready to present and think on your feet. That was amazing. I mean, hard. But then, you know,
I don't even remember doing it. That's how not like how it just felt like another day at our job, because we like they did that to us all the time.
All the time.
Tumor boards, Goldberg grounds, Shazat, right? Like it was just great. Like part of breathing. Your chiefs would pimp you. Like it was just part of being there, that there was just so much learning all the time, like from the attendings. And that was such a gift.
Yeah. I mean, but I probably did like bolus learning the nights before I was going to stand up.
Bolus learning. I'll take a leader bolus of the practice bulletin.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely did. You know, another thing I learned in residency was how to speak Spanish. I mean, I speak Spanish now, and I have half my patients are Spanish speaking only. And I'm so happy. It's great. I mean, I speak Bronx accent Spanish.
Oh my God. Can you demonstrate? How do you say, like, you have
por favor, a
normal abnormality?
Dime.
I do all of it. But I remember that when I was there at Einstein, I probably wasn't attending, but one of the patients asked me, ¿Está Boricua? And I'm like,
no. Oh, you have a Puerto Rican accent.
Yeah. But all the way.
Mine's Dominican.
You could be Jewish, you could be Italian, you could be Puerto Rican, you could be, people think you're from anywhere and everywhere.
Yes.
My Spanish accent got changed spending 4 years at Columbia, so now I'm Dominican.
Oh, yeah. And now my patients aren't from neither of those places. They're more from Central America, which
yeah. And my patients now ask me if I'm Dominican.
Really?
Yeah.
Once somebody start from Dominican Republic starts speaking, I sort of lose track because it's so fast. I just look at them with this blank stare on my face because I'm like, espacio, por favor.
It's like every other syllable.
Right.
And that's how I learned, because like when I start saying things, they like look at me and they're like, Dominican? And I'm like,
that's funny.
The funny thing is that
Bronx and Washington Heights.
Well, we all tried, and some of us tried harder than others. And I remember that I think one of the residents wanted to get permission to deliver the baby with forceps. And so she thought she was saying, I'm going to put 2 spoons on the baby's head to deliver the head. But instead she said, I'm going to put 2 knives on the baby's head. So then the couple, this sweet couple, are just staring at her. And they just wouldn't even respond. They're just like shocked. Like, what are you doing? And they didn't consent.
Like these crazy Americans are trying to slice up our baby's head.
Yeah. And I mean, I saw a lot of funny things like that. I was once with a resident who was trying to say push, and he was trying to say empuja, but instead he was yelling puta mama puta, and then someone, I had no idea, and then like someone was like, you know, you're like calling her a
oh my god.
And then my other one was that I was once doing a delivery and this woman was screaming and she kept saying, ay, coño, coño, ay, coño. So I said, what is coño? I'm like, oh, can you tell me what is coño? They're like, it's shit. So that's how I learned.
Well, I mean, there's lots of different languages. So I actually learned push in Albanian,
yep.
Which is shtu. And then of course there's French. So there was a Senegalese patient and, she was French speaking. And so she was a young girl and everybody was screaming in the room, pussy, pussy, the whole room, pussy, pussy, pussy. And she pussy that baby.
In fact, Stacey Lee Rubin, it went through my hand. She poussed so hard. When hand, Stacey Lee Rubin, like almost like catching a football, caught this baby. And then she had like, Tamar, you could talk about your TGBO, but like she had a blowout, okay? Yeah. Like a stellate, awful thing, because she poussed so hard.
When you had to get wool off, there was like that one night nurse at Jacoby. That you had to like go find her because they never had a Wolof interpreter on the translation line. And you're like, God damn it. I have to go find that lady. Where is she?
I know a little Wolof, actually.
I know you do.
Any Wolof?
But you didn't know it when you were a monkey resident.
No. I didn't know any Wolof. Actually, I only know like how, do you speak Wolof? And then how are you? Something like that. That was from Ghana, but anyway.
More than most of us.
That's Senegalese. Yeah. That's so funny.
I was once in the Montefiore ER. So remember when you would take call second year at night by yourself for GYN, and the patients were stacked layer and layer and layer of people, right? So I was doing this interview with a patient and I said to her, like, what language do you speak? And she said, Mixteco Bajo. And I thought she was saying that she's from Mexico. So I'm like, don't worry, I got this, right? So I'm trying to interview her. Nothing's making any sense. And then again, I said, again, what language do you speak? And she said, Mixteco Bajo, again, back and forth. So then I got a translator on and she's like, she doesn't speak Spanish. This is a special dialect of the high
islands of Mexico.
Of the mountains in Mexico, whatever, in Mexico. She's like, you're never going to get anywhere, right? So, I mean, I didn't even know half the languages that existed that I then eventually learned to ask for.
Yeah, the language thing is fascinating because now at MIMO, my top ones that I use are like Uzbek, Russian, Urdu, Bengali, and Mandarin.
Oh,
wow. Like Mandarin's probably the number one. So like I know how to count to three and do like my handful of things in Mandarin.
Well, thank goodness you got experience at Montefiore, you know, at least learning how to use the translator.
Right.
They teach you what the right way to do it is, right? You're supposed to talk to the patient and let the traducer, whatever the translator, translate for you. But a lot of people talk to the translator. Tell her that she needs, you know, and it's a skill.
Oh, it totally is. But you have to take a deep breath and like know that it's going to be painful. Like, you know, just it's going to take at least double the time if you're going to have a complicated conversation, right? Like if I'm going to talk to somebody about the fetus is small, we don't know if it's because of a genetic issue or a placental issue, and this is what we're going to monitor, that conversation is going to take a long time, right? And then sometimes you say, do you have any questions? And then you get back like, so everything's okay with the baby? Oh, shoot. We have to start all over again.
Like translator, what exactly did you say?
So it's very challenging, but I mean, it's very, very challenging.
It's so cool though, to like work, I think particularly in OBGYN, because you learn so much about different cultures' views on like birth and breastfeeding and periods and contraception and sex. Like it's like so many different cultures, like between my time in the Bronx and Washington Heights and now in South Brooklyn, like I know so much about the different Americanized versions of these immigrant cultures that like we live amongst. And I'm fascinated by it. I learn something new every day, like at Maimonides. I love it. I think it's so cool.
It's so true. Oh my God. I mean, we learned that some of the patients from Africa would prefer to labor fully naked, unmonitored, without any IVs, and just like in the hallway, kind of like dancing and swaying their hips from side to side. And we were all like, but we need to monitor the baby. What if the baby goes on the floor? You know, like, and they're just like, get your IV away from me.
Right.
I love that dance. I loved it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Jacoby was definitely the place where you got to see everything and anything and everything from every, and you know, and you start to see patterns after a while. It's hard to sort of distinguish between being a little bit biased, but also sort of actually seeing these patterns.
Right. Cultural sensitivity versus cultural bias.
Yeah, very, yeah.
Yeah,
you mentioned the naked lady. I had a lady. I love the story because it was just like it was sort of to me, it was one of the struggles of being the intern, right? Like that, how you make, you're told to make it happen, make it work, and the struggles of actually having to like interact with the patient and deal with it and just like figure it out. And basically, I think it may have been you, Kathleen. I was supposed to do an EKG on this lady, and she was very big chested. She's like, you know, so in order to do this EKG, I had to like
get up in there
and literally play Twister because none of the stickers would stay on. So I had my hands and my feet, everything was like trying to hold these stickers on because I knew I could not leave this room without the EKG. And the lady very simply goes, "I'm very well lotioned."
You're like, "Yep, I noticed."
Thanks a lot for being so well lotioned. My God, could you make this any harder?
She's like, "There's not an ashy inch on this ass."
No, she's very proud of her lotion. I mean, who knows if she was having an MI? She was very well lotioned. Yeah, yeah,
and proud.
Yeah,
I remember that in Jacoby, we used to talk about how the extravagance of the eye makeup was usually directly related to how crazy the delivery was going to be. Because one of the ones in particular was a woman who came in, she was young, I want to say like early 20s, and she had hot pink, like shockingly 1980s hot pink eyelashes.
Eyelashes.
Okay. And like, and whoever I was with, I think I must have been either a one or a two because I was definitely the one who ended up doing the delivery. So I couldn't have been the senior. And I just remember I looked at whoever was with me and I was like, this is going to be a shit show. And of course it was. So she was on the bed and of course no epidural. And so while pushing, she hops up onto her feet on the bed and starts screaming. The head is now out of her body and she points at the baby head that is now hanging out of her vagina. Oh, and she screams and says, "I'm going to fucking kill you." And she just looked at me and then she like sat back down and then like we finished delivering the baby. And I was just like, holy fucking shit. I knew this was bad from the eyelashes. Those eyelashes showed up and you just knew something crazy like this. And the nurses were like, "Do you think we should call social work?" I was like, "I don't think that that is going to solve anything that's happening in this room right now."
No. I mean, we had people, right. In Jacoby, we had like our security running around following family, like running through the different halls and floors of the hospital because the partners or the patients were armed or threatening. And I mean, we had chases in the hospital. That was
chases.
There was this, I remember there
was a lot of family drama on labor and delivery, both places actually.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's different, right? Like, so there were like, we had family drama a lot. I once got really stuck my foot in my mouth because I saw this baby daddy and we're in triage and I'm admitting his girlfriend because she's in labor, and I go to him, "How do I know you?" He's like, "I don't know." And he didn't seem to be interested. And I was like, "I mean, really? Like, are you from New Jersey?" And he's like, he's nothing. I said, "I can't get over this. I know you. I really know you. It's going to kill me until I figure it out. I don't know how I know you." And over, I would not stop. And then, of course, then I finally realized I just delivered this guy's baby last week with a different mama.
Your lack of self-awareness around your lack of filter is such one of the most beautiful things about you.
You are so innocent.
You're the only person that I know who can get away with that and still be such a lovely human, because the rest of us would just be like, "What a bitch. Why would that, like, how could you not know?" That's the similar story to me of the guy who came up to me when I was a chief and he was like, "Hey doc, I need your help." And I was like, "What's up?" So we had just rolled in, him and his wife, and the baby mama was rolling into the room next door. And he was like, "If these two see each other, I might not make it alive." And I was like, "Understood." So we got the charge nurse and so it was Weiler. So then they put the other one like in the back corner so that they were literally like as far apart as they possibly could be. And I was like, only, only here. Like, oh, like, and I was just like, dude, you couldn't have had them delivering at different hospitals. Like,
wait, I remember that. That must be because I remember once we had that and there was a big fight that broke out postpartum.
Yes. Yeah. Right? And there was like concerns about like someone bringing a gun to the hospital. Like, yeah.
Well, I had that story, but I know that happened at Jacoby also, yeah. Where his wife delivered and then his girlfriend was preterm, went into preterm labor, and they were both on post at the same time. And he was like, they can't share the room certainly. And could you put them at different ends of the hall? That definitely happened. The gun situation, I don't know if this is what you're referring to, but this is where Sarah Friedman is like one of the greatest people on the planet. She's so, as far as
floppy ponytails,
yes, but like maternal and amazing and magical. And but I made the very dangerous mistake as an intern of checking this woman without a chaperone, and it was like a situation where the girlfriend of this guy was here for preterm labor. She'd had 7 prior sections and she only wanted Dr. Gary, and she P-prommed with her 7 prior sections. So she was on L&D, and his brother had just gotten out of jail and brought his baby mama with her. But she was upset because she wasn't getting all the attention. So they came to triage, that couple. So they were sitting in triage and she kept saying that she was having pain. And I examined her. I didn't think she was in preterm labor. So the third time he calls me in to examine her, I was like, ugh, you're not in labor. Like, God, you know? And I made the mistake of examining her. And he accused me of violating his girlfriend. And then he got in my face and threatened me with death. Do you know I just got out of jail? I'll fucking kill you. And I was mortified. And the nurse was like, I think it was a Roscoe. No, it was one of the other nurses. And she was like, yeah, your fault. You didn't have me in there. I can't see what happened.
Well, that's important, kiddo.
Yeah, exactly. So I like went and hid in the room, and we wanted the nurse manager to do something, right? Like, because he was threatening. And she was like, famously was like, no, he's the father of, you know, a patient here. He has every right to be here. And Sarah was like, no, they're threatening our staff. Like, hello. And it actually, she wrote a letter to the president of HHC to tell them, I think, that we felt unsafe and that nobody at the hospital was doing anything to make us safer. Well, she's so amazing.
She's amazing. And we didn't know what we were doing. Nobody was trained like that. We didn't get any kind of safety training, you know, and we
You would just put me out in triage when this crazy psych patient who was bigger than I am out there. And I was like, it's fine. I'll go out there. I'm the biggest one here. I'm like, it's fine. And like the poor nurses, like one of them got like a Gatorade bottle, like chucked at her at like a fastball, and she got like a massive bruise. But I like sat out there with that crazy psych patient like for my whole shift, because they were coming to get her to take her to the psych hospital, and it took the whole shift.
Wow.
And she was walking around naked in her third trimester in triage in front of all the other patients.
Oh, this is in Weiler, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We had that. They would come. Some people would come and they weren't actually pregnant, and they thought they were pregnant and they were in labor, and they would be in triage, wailing, screaming, you really think a baby's coming? And the nurses were so used to it that they just, like, she's stripped down, she's totally undressed in front of everybody, lying on the floor. The nurse took a sheet, covered her, and we just carried on
like nothing happened.
Like, she's there, and we're just all moving around. There are 5 other triage rooms, and we were just waiting for, like, the psychiatrist team to come and get the patient. And, you know.
I will never forget this patient that I saw at Jacoby that you said the story. And she was this woman, same story. She came in, you think the head's coming out, right? And then you examine her, and you're an intern, and you're like, it doesn't feel like all of my other exams, but there's definitely not a baby coming. And then you look her up in the computer and you see that she was in the hospital in the ED the day before and she had a negative beta. And right. So I was like, miss, you're not pregnant. And so then she pulls out the piece of the printout that says HCG negative. She had circled it in crayon. And she was like, no, but this piece of paper says that I'm pregnant. And she had circled it in crayon. And I was like, oh, okay, now I know what I'm dealing with. She's like, look. And I'm like, I am looking at it. And it actually says the exact opposite. It says you are not pregnant. You are definitely not having a baby because that is dated yesterday. And it says negative.
And like, these are amazing stories. And you feel so alive when you're doing these things. You're just like, wow, you know, like, this is interesting. This is amazing. Like, that story is amazing. I mean, when patients cursed me out, I was happy. I'm like, okay, fine. You're very angry right now. Something's not going right in your life. It's fine.
Something residencies don't need a wellness curriculum. They need a couple of hours with Dr. Goldwasser.
Yeah.
Completely reset your perspective on every single thing you do every day.
Tamar, yeah. This is not as bad as the Holocaust.
I mean, like, I was going to say it, but like, yeah, that was my mantra.
I know. Remember.
It's very messed up, but you would say, why are you so happy? And I was just like, well, we're the ones learning. We're the ones like doing this. We're not being persecuted. So, you know, this isn't so bad. This is great.
And then you had Tal being like, this is worse than the IDF.
Yeah.
I do think too, like because particularly in my field of family planning, like I oftentimes see patients having the worst day of their life. And it's like, yeah, all I got to do is see one patient to be like, I'm fine.
Right.
My life is fine. I am incredibly privileged. I am fine because this woman, she's having a much worse day than I am. So whatever's going on in my shit, she's fine. Trauma is a very individualized thing, and there has not been a single thing in my life that has happened to me that has caused me trauma.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
Wow. That is kind of amazing.
Well, I feel like I've had things that like have come back and that have stuck with me, and that like when I really thought about it, I felt like were clogging me up in a way, you know, or like made me build up some walls. Like I've been through things that have done that to me that have made me... you know, like survive or whatever, but yeah.
I've had things in my life that were hard.
Right.
But not traumatizing.
Yeah.
Do you think that is
overused?
Do you think, so it's interesting because Lisa also said she loved, like it was hard, but she loved all of it. Right. And mm-hmm. I said the same thing. I freaking loved it. No matter how hard it was, right? It was really hard. There were times when that were really, really tough. And, but you come out of it, like we loved it for so many reasons. But do you think that some of the people who did experience it and sort of perceive it as trauma, maybe, I don't know, had different seniors or like had just like, I don't know. Like, why do you think that they were traumatized and others came out of it with a completely different perspective?
I don't know. When I was in medical school, they made this announcement, like, cancel all your plans. And when you're done here, you're going to be a completely different person. And in order to become a doctor, you have to go all in.
Mm.
So I really took that to heart, and I was like, this is such an amazing thing that I'm doing. And I felt like I'm going to go all in. And so I don't know. I didn't think it was, I was never offended by the amount of work I was asked to do. I was just like, okay, this is the work that needs to get done. I was overwhelmed sometimes and I didn't know what I should do first. And I forgot things, but I felt it was my responsibility because I'm given this opportunity and I'm learning how to become an OBGYN. And so I felt whatever, I'm part of this team. I looked around and saw how much had to be done at all times. And so I was never I don't know. I didn't feel like it was wrong for anyone to ask me to do anything. No one ever asked me to do something that had nothing to do with being a doctor. You know, even if it was like run this lab down to the basement,
right?
I felt like, yes, I'm going to do that. And I'm going to run as fast as I can without dropping it so that we could get the result. And maybe we could help her a minute earlier. So, you know, I mean, I really did feel like that. Being a doctor and taking care of a whole range of, you know, patients, it's really good. It's just good to ground you and to realize, like, puts everything into perspective.
Yeah. And I think that to me is the mindset that allowed those of us in our era to survive that place and look back on it fondly. Because I do think there is a Monty mindset. I actually just met a GI subspecialist who started at MIMO this week. And I was vibing with her and I was like, where'd you train? She's like, oh, I just came from Monty. And I was like, yep.
Bingo.
You can spot them. And so I said to her, because I told her, I was like, we call ourselves Monty South here because, like, there's so many of us who, like, did training or spent significant amounts of time up there. I was like, because this is a very similar place. Like, it's a safety net hospital with, like, a high Medicaid patient population where, like, we all really give a shit and, like, we do the work even if it's not actually our job kind of place. And she's like, oh, yeah, I am that person too. She's like, oh, good, I'll fit right in here. I was like, yeah, I could already tell that something about you was, like, you're going to be just fine here.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what when I say that, like, Monty's in my blood, I feel like anyone who's trained there, I immediately have this connection with, you know, and I don't know how to totally put my finger on it. Is it where it was? Is it the type of person who wants to be there? Right. You're probably pretty progressive. You're probably have an extremely big heart. You're extremely hardworking. You're very type A. Really rigor, you're not afraid of hard things. And then you step away from that really difficult environment and can absolutely appreciate everything, the person you are now that you've been through it. And on top of that, you can pay it forward to not only trainees, but also the patients in these other clinical environments. I feel so privileged. Nothing really phases me anymore. I feel like I saw everything. I've interacted with almost every single personality probably.
And it's so much fun. I liked meeting the older women too, because they had such great life stories and you're like, oh wow, that could happen later in life. Like, we had this woman who was in the hospital for the first time in her whole life and she was in her 90s. And
wow.
Like, you're amazing. And she's like, I really want to get out of here. Like, I don't go to the hospital. I'm fine. And she was like newly married and had a whole new like life. And I loved it. I just
life at 90. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Go for
yeah.
her.
Yeah. 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 I loved it.
That para zero where like their cervix is completely effaced, mm-hmm. but actually the opening to their cervix is like back behind the head and it's only like 1 centimeter dilated. So they're like 1 and 100 and plus 2, but like you feel head and you're like, she's fully. And so then like they roll her and then he like goes in, doesn't clean his hands, puts gloves on, checks, takes his gloves off, walks out of the room, doesn't clean his hands again. And
then she's on your
pen. And he's like, she's 1 centimeter and just walks away. And I was like, what?
Oh.
Yeah, I remember talking to myself when I was checking a patient. And like, that head, that bulging head can feel like it's fully dilated. And then I remember thinking, I'm searching with my fingers.
Open it.
Like, where is it? It could be on the right.
You got to walk around the whole 10 centimeters of the head to find that opening.
I 100% had the same story. And Mary Rosser walks in because the patient was not acting like she wanted to push. And I'm like, she's fully. And she walked in and she was like, she's not fully. And she was not fully. She was that pinpoint.
Yeah.
But they do go quickly because
it's a face.
Yeah. Like once it opens, it opens.
You know that, Kathleen, you know, when I was an intern, at some point the chiefs were like, you're not allowed to ask anyone about their social history anymore because it's totally distracting.
Like when Tamar was just talking about the old ladies and their stories, I was like, I didn't know any old ladies' stories. I don't ask about their stories. If they tell me their stories, I listen, but I don't ask about the stories.
I was like, but why did you come at 3 o'clock in the morning because of like that? That can't be the real reason you
came. Why did you take an ambulance?
But you are ingenious because actually I tell people that when they call me at 3 and they're like, this patient has been here for 3 hours and I can't figure out what her complaint is. And I said, did you ask her why she is here? Like, did you ask her if she's safe? If she's in trouble, if there's something she really wants to reach out for help. And twice in the last 2 months, we got a positive answer. One admitted to actually having suicidal ideation and ended up like being like, I didn't want to go home. I'm having horrible thoughts. And that's because of you. And you, yes, because, and it wasn't just you. I think it was Amita as well, Murthy, who was like, if they come in at 3 a.m. for vaginal discharge on an ambulance, there's obviously something else that brought them here.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that definitely came from you. And
let me tell you, the two positive screens, that's just because the other ones aren't ready to tell you.
Right. Or they don't have Tamar listening and getting it out of them.
Oh my God. I got way into it. It was crazy. I mean, I'm like, guys, you don't understand what's going on in that household.
You're like, why do you know so much about how many people they live with? You're like, and then the sister and the mother, and the cousin. You're like, but she just came out to rule out rupture. What's going on?
Like, she just needs to stay here for a while. And they're like, no. I mean, right. And it's hard. I remember thinking someone would come in for bleeding and then you would evaluate them and there was no bleeding. So you were thrilled. You're like, I did this, 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 and that. There's no blood. I did the ultrasound. So anyway, everything's good. And then you're happy to send them home. And then eventually it dawned on me like that. Okay. Well, then something happened, right? Like, she's saying that the whole bed was covered with blood and you're seeing nothing. Okay, so, but like, either it happened and it's nothing left, but still that's a problem, or something else is going on. Like, that's not a normal story and you just send her home, but you're tired and you want to just get on with it.
So is this the part where we talk about kids these days? No, I meant the residency.
Oh, the kids. Oh, those kids. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard. You know, they're very different sort of mindset and they look, I don't know how they feel about you, but they look at me like I have three heads and, you know, and as far as like evaluations go, it's taken me a really long time to sort of navigate that because in the beginning, the evaluations weren't so hot. I was too hard on people. And now I'm starting to sort of better understand them and see the value. And they're extremely compassionate people. And their mindset is much more open, I feel like, than maybe ours. But they also value their own time. And so it's different. That wasn't very profound, but what do you guys think?
I don't work with students right now, which I'm sad about. But I remember one time there was a resident that was in your class who ended up leaving our residency. I feel like it was partially because of me, because she went to go evaluate a patient with tachycardia and she came back and then she told me everything that was going on. And then I said, and what's her hematocrit and hemoglobin? And she's like, I didn't check that. And I was like, and I said, you didn't check that. That's really important. And then she goes, because I'm an idiot and I'm a moron. She's hysterically crying. And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it for emphasis, but forget it. Like, you know, it's just like you said it at the wrong time and the wrong nerve and everything went crashing down. But I mean, I think it's okay to be hard and tough. I mean, you have people's lives on the line.
The privilege of taking care of not one, sometimes up to four people at once, whatever. I mean, you have such a big onus, a big responsibility, and people are putting their entire lives in your hands. I mean, talk about the trust that they're putting in you. I mean, that responsibility is immeasurable, right? If you don't take that seriously, I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think eventually you could calm down and you can be less intense once you become really experience and confident and you understand that not everything is a 10 in terms of acuity. And so, but I think in residency, it's okay to kind of keep everything hot and important.
But I do think in that same, like the stories that you guys are telling, like one thing I've learned is that like, let the chiefs be the mean guys because it's handled better. And it's also like, it's more important for like that team dynamic. And I do think that Thomasina Ellison, who's one of the more senior surgeons, she's a Brooklyn native. And she just heard me talking about something one time in triage and she just started laughing at me. And I was like, what? She goes, oh, it's cute. You give a shit. get older, you'll give less of a shit. Like, it's just not that important. And I'm like, oh, you're right. I think with like maturity and age and wisdom, right? Like, yeah. And I do think I'm definitely like a lot more whatever, because you're kind of like, it's just not like, I'm not going to bother anymore. And first of all, I have a very thick skin in general when it comes to feedback. I'm not here to make friends. I made every single intern when I was a chief cry, and someone told me that once, and I was like, good. Like, I don't know if you're telling me that because you thought that was going to affect me negatively in some way, but like, I cried when I was an intern, and I cried when I was a second year. Like, I can tell you, like, every single instance when I cried, Nellie Fisher made me cry, but it didn't have anything to do with Nellie. It had everything to do with me. Right. I was the one crying. It wasn't that Nellie made me cry. It was that there was a situation that she was involved in, and I was so tired and so stressed out, and I was so disappointed in myself that I cried.
Right.
And that was okay. Like, who cares? Like, people cry, especially when you're exhausted emotionally and mentally. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that meant if everybody is as intuitive as you are sort of illustrating right now. I think that there are people who project onto other people. Certainly we bring our lives to work with us because it is really hard to compartmentalize completely. And I know that I did that a lot. Like, there was like a lot of evolution of the type of attending I am because of the marital problems I was having and the things that I was bringing to work and probably projecting on other people and my fear of failure and also my desire to, as a junior attending, to want to be seen and want to sort of climb that ladder. And I'm sure that I made a lot of mistakes in how I interacted with people, especially when it was when it was hard. And then when I cried as an intern, it was both everything you said, but it was also like, why is this person being so hard on me? Can't they see that I'm just trying my best here? And so there was also sort of that wallowing and self-pity. I don't know if you had that, but I had that for sure.
I can tell you, never in my life have I ever said in my head, why are they being so hard on me?
Is that from your military parenting?
No, it's just my parents in general. Like, yeah. It's just that feeling of like, suck it up.
Me too.
Either fix it or you can't fix it. So move on. Like, it's just this ability to just, because like, I know I can literally, like, I remember Ellen Landsberger and I was on ANTI and my patients, AST and ALT started to go up and she was a cholestasis patient. I don't know anything about cholestasis. It was like my first week on ANTI. It was July of second year. And I was the first one doing the hard rotation as always. And it was like, and then she just looked at me and she was like, why wouldn't you tell me that? And I was like, because I didn't know that it was important and I'm learning. And then she like left and then I cried. And I was just like, fuck, I should have known that. Like, that was on me. Like,
but also you said that to her?
No.
Oh.
Right.
It's a very healthy and mature thing to say to somebody.
No, I'm sure I said I'm sorry.
Right.
And I internalized it all because, like, she's not wrong. Like, I should have known that, but I didn't know yet. And I would learn it. And I just did. And I'm moving on.
We're still learning. In fact, my, I don't know if my daughter's asleep right now, but basically her singing teacher told me, you know, she says sorry every time I correct her. And I'm telling her that she has nothing to be sorry about. She's just in the learning process. So if I correct her, it's not anything she should be sorry about. And I'm so grateful that this person said this to me because I didn't realize she was doing that. And I realize a lot of us do that, but you are absolutely right. We are in, as trainees, even now, we're in this process where we're still learning. We're always learning, and what we don't know, we sort of have to admit, oh my God, I actually didn't know that.
Since this is your first all women podcast thing, we can talk about the women saying I'm sorry for things that they shouldn't be sorry for bullshit.
Yes.
You know, I have my husband trained now because he always works with women, right? Because he's in medicine. And so he always has like a ton of women around him. And he now has, and like his woman that he works with a lot told me, she said, do you know that your husband corrects women when they apologize for things that they shouldn't apologize for? And I was like, oh, I love him so dearly.
And look then at Kathleen, like, fixing the world, right?
No, it's not fixing the world. It's fixing like the bullshit hierarchy, patriarchy that we live in
the world now.
I have this lovely mug in my office that I use during my Zoom meetings that says, I have 99 problems and most of them are white heteronormative patriarchy. And so when I have Zoom meetings with like all white men at my job, I'll like drink my coffee with it fully in view.
Oh, see, I have a poster over here that says, sometimes I wish I was an octopus so I could slap 8 people at once.
Oh, so good. And I think that Taylor Swift wrote a beautiful song, which is called If I Was a Man, Then I'd Be the Man. And I was like, I can't believe no one ever wrote that song before. Like, I can't believe it.
You'll love this one, Melissa. I'm going to make this into a mug or a t-shirt for my former resident who taught it to me. I only have 2 eyes to roll.
When Jordan was learning like the parts of the body, I was like, okay, what is the nose for? Smelling. What are the ears for? Hearing. What are the eyes for? Rolling.
Yeah. Oh, God. That is definitely your kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, you know, why I feel like I need to put this in there, but about like men and women and the workforce. But a few times when I was a resident, I did experience male attendings hitting on me, trying to touch me in inappropriate ways, calling me and leaving me inappropriate messages. And that was eye-opening. And, you know, I remember thinking, but that is gross. So I remember I was very strategic about where I put my pager. So I put the pager on the exact side of my hip so that if anyone ever had to reach into my operating gown to get it, they would not be reaching in the front or in the back. They would go on the side, and I would never keep it clipped to my top. And I remember seeing people like, or at least thinking that they were like looking down my shirt when I was leaning forward. I started to wear tank tops. Like, I felt that all around all the time. And it was shocking. I was like, I feel like there are some people who are constantly just trying to get their thrill. And if someone bites, they bite. I mean, that was when I learned all that.
Yeah. God. Also, you have a really nice rack tomorrow. Let's be
honest. Thanks. Oh my God.
It was that might be the truest thing that we've said at podcasts.
Wow. I mean, yeah, that's when I learned that stuff too.
I could imagine that was the first time that you really like experienced that in life. Cause that was probably a time when you really were in the more intimate settings with men. Cause like I'd been dealing with that for way too long.
Right. I mean, right. I mean, you know, I went to yeshiva for my whole schooling until I graduated high school. And then I went to Barnard for college.
Right.
So that was protected. And then I was at Mount Sinai, but you know, it was not at like, you know, you're in a classroom setting for 2 years and yeah. Then, you know,
no, residency is very intimate.
Very.
You're all up in each other's business.
I remember someone reached into my gown to get my pager and said into my ear, too bad it wasn't in the front.
Stop it. Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's awful.
The thing is that I don't even remember these things because it's like, to me, it's just it's like part of being a woman is this shit just happens to you.
Yeah. But that was that. Right. So that's when I started to.
Experience it.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was this talk at ACOG that I loved, and it was a woman who, it was like their quote unquote wellness talk. And I'm always like, I'll see how this goes. But there were 3 things about her talk that I loved. The first one was the only 2 things that have been shown repeatedly scientifically to be helpful with your mindset are swearing and exercise.
Oh.
And I was like, done.
Fuck yeah.
And her and one of her colleagues started to have this quiet thing that they did across the table to each other that no one knew what they were doing, but they would say MOMF, which was MOMF, which was move on, motherfucker. And it was their way of basically saying like, let it go, like move the fuck on. So like when you were just talking about like being happy in your job, like if you're not happy in your job, then move on, motherfucker. Like, yeah. Go find your happiness then. Like, don't be in that place. But then her third part, which is the most important part of all of it, is that the only thing you can ever control in this whole fucked up shit show fire, like dumpster fire that is life, because that is what the dumpster fire is. Life is a dumpster fire, is your mindset about it. That's the only thing you can control. Mm-hmm. Can't make it less of a dumpster fire. You can't actually change the world. Like, you have to just live in it and get through it and like figure out your pockets of happiness. And the only thing that you can actually control is your mindset.
You know, that's, you could be my therapist. And but my therapist said something very similarly, you know, like if you're not finding complete sort of, not complete happiness, because what is that? But, you know, if you're not fully satisfied or you're looking for something else to do, find it. And that's what this was. This was like an idea that cropped up that maybe we could, I talk about residency all the time. Maybe I'm like one of those children who never grew up or something.
You're living your high school days over and over.
Yeah, exactly. And I do. I live through the stories. I remember them like yesterday. I remember a lot of things. And certainly I only remember my experience from them. And I wanted to hear everybody's experience.
The things about residency that are like the most poignant to me is when either I observed someone else really messing up or I myself really messed up. Like the time one of our Ankh fellows accidentally took a Nednexa that she was not supposed to take. And I was in the room and I was standing there. And it was that thing where you were the Ankh person. And so you were in the room waiting for a good time for the break in the surgery for you to bring up stuff. And then I needlessly left the room without getting the information that I needed. Cause I was like, this is so uncomfortable to be in this room right now. And they don't know that I'm here and he's yelling at her. And it was just, yeah, vivid, very vivid. And it was not an attending who got upset very often too. So it was like super uncomfortable.
Well, that stuff sticks with you for sure.
Yeah. It was very memorable.
Dr. Kuo once said the following to me when we were doing like something for vaginal cancer, or labial cancer, something like that. So we were like removing the labia and putting it back together, whatever was left of it. And he says, if Dr. Goldwasser sews any slower, I am going to fall asleep.
He said that a lot in general. It wasn't just you.
Oh, okay. And I was like, so then I even said to him, I said, I know, but if you rush me, I'm going to go slower.
Then I'm going to get nervous.
But I'll never forget that.
Yeah, he's a good egg.
So good.
He's the best.
I tell people the story about how Gary Goldberg gave me the biggest compliment by looking across the table from me when I asked him for a letter for fellowship. And he said, you're still going to do this family planning thing? Such a shame. And I just smiled at him and I was like, thank you.
Oh my God.
I got something similar compliment. From him. Oh, no, it was very, he called you into your office and with his, you know, accent and, you know, so Melissa, what are you going to do? I think I'm just going to be a generalist, you know, and that what a shame thing. That was, it felt really good.
Oh, it was a huge compliment. And I told him that. I said, I don't know if you mean this as a compliment or not, but I'm taking it as one. Because mm-hmm. I'm going to take anything I can get around here.
I spoke to Dr. Merkatz at the beginning of our chief year because he wanted to know what I wanted to do after I graduated. And I was really undecided because I loved everything. And I had been thinking about REI initially. And then, you know, I don't know. I had a lot of ideas and I didn't have any like put together plans for them. And he said, you're so unfocused. And I started crying. And then I was like, but you know, when I am focused is when I'm with my patients. I am very focused when I'm with my patients. And then I couldn't stop crying.
Oh, and yeah. You told him that?
Yeah. I go,
what for you?
I'm like, I'm focused when I'm with my patients.
I'm not sure I ever had a single conversation with him.
It was so uncomfortable. The couch I sat on was very low down and my knee, I was wearing a skirt. My knees were higher than my hips. And I was like putting my hands on my knees. So uncomfortable. And I had just gotten married and then I was crying. And then he goes, they're there. Okay.
And then he gets uncomfortable.
Like, you got married. Everything's good. And then I was like, I think I just need to leave this room because I'm not going to stop crying for a while.
Yeah, no, I will. It's funny, like the old school way of like thinking that you should guide people's feelings on their future.
Yeah.
Why did people think that that was a good idea? Like, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. Like,
yeah.
That's a terrible idea.
Right. I mean, looking back, I do think that it might have been fine to say, it's okay if you're not sure. Just do what you were just trained to do. Like, we just trained you to become an OBGYN now.
Also, being a generalist is not it's not because you couldn't decide.
Right, exactly. So I just feel like that wasn't, it didn't have to be bad. It could have just been like, you know what? You love everything. That's amazing. Just now practice OBGYN.
Yeah. Like we have a bunch who come into my residency and their first and second year, they like confirm. They're like definitely generalist.
Right. Wow. That's great.
Generalist is I mean, I absolutely love being a generalist. Isn't that why we went into OBGYN? We love the spectrum of, it's basically every single
thing. It's not why I did. I went in to do abortions. Oh, I tolerated oncology and.
I mean, that is like, that is you though. You are like so super focused and resolute. I mean, if we could only have like a, if each of us could have a sliver of your confidence and your empathy, I think we'd be like all better people. But he also said that to me on that couch, you know, but I had a vision. I was like, why don't you see my vision? I can be global health and education and family planning and da, 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 da. And I was like, I see it all fitting together really nicely into this beautiful like mosaic. You don't see this? You know, he basically was like, no, you're all over the place. You need more focus.
What department are you going to be in? How much are we going to pay you? Right? Like, how much call are you going to be required to do? We need to define what you are, right? Like, that's part of it. You know that's part of it.
I mean, yes. I wanted to be in a place where I could just develop into the flower that I was always meant to be. And I think I've manifested pretty well in terms of the vision that I had, because all of that stuff that I liked to do really helps me now. Mm-hmm. And I think you can be whatever you want to be in this field, especially.
I was saying that to a male medical student last week who I ended up having a very lovely conversation with. But I was like, OBGYN is great because it doesn't really close a lot of doors. So if you like any aspect of OBGYN, like there are people who do half-time jobs. There are people who do shift work. There are people who like are crazy solo practitioners who like literally like live and die for their patients and love it and like deliver every single patient and like do two generations of women in the family. Like you and everything in between. Like there's so many things in our field.
I mean, I think it's very special because other fields really don't want to touch the pregnant patient, right? Like the ER does, you know, they just, please take them off our hands. So we need to be, I mean, we have to be there.
Pregnant patient. They don't want to touch the female patient.
Right.
Yeah. They're like, I think she has an ovarian cyst. Please come see her.
Right.
You're like, actually she has an appendicitis, but that's okay. You guys can take care of her now that we helped you diagnose that.
I mean, and I ended up becoming mostly an educator for my patients to help them make decisions having to do that involved genetics. Like that's what I ended up really primarily doing, which I love. So I feel like what I'm doing is breaking down complex ideas and complex things to help people make practical decisions in very like emotionally charged scenarios, you know, and like giving them the time they need. And I think it was good for me because I need the time too. Like I like that. And then sometimes we'll say, okay, we have to come back, let that sink in. We can make these decisions later, you know? So, but I think genetics has become huge in pregnancy planning. And I think it's also important for having healthy babies. And I like that it can be applied for across the board to all patients of all socioeconomic statuses. And I really like that it's being used and like supported by ACOG, like NIPT and carrier screening, you know, it's not just for the elite, which is good.
Definitely your niche, Tamar. It fits well with your personality and who you are.
You have so many gifts and, you know, and you just like keep giving.
But I do miss, I closed a lot of doors. I really miss delivering babies a lot.
I'm sure you do.
And I also really miss, I loved doing hysterectomies with, but that door closed a long, long time ago, but I loved all that stuff. I loved laparoscopy and and yeah. medical student.
Fun.
Yeah.
I don't get them in there all that often outside of my like regular family planning stuff. But when I do, I'm always like, yay. Like when we did the torsion this morning, I was like, oh, this is fun.
So nice.
I was like, torsion times two, called it.
Oh, wow. You know who taught me? Scarlett Karakesh would always say, just go and see the patient and examine the patient and you decide like clinically, are they okay or are they not okay? Are they well or are they not well?
Scarlett is one of these people. Okay, so we had our team, right? It was Scarlett, you, Erica, and me, and we had this night team. Tamar, do you remember this night team?
Oh yeah.
My, it was just, it felt like family, and it just like I looked forward to this. I never looked forward to really, in hindsight, I never looked forward to residency so much as just being with you three. But Scarlett was one of those people that you meet, and you're just like, damn, you are so smart. You were so good at this. And, you know, whether she never told me that, but that is like something that I say too, just go see the patient. Mm-hmm. You don't have to wait for any of this. The getting the next imaging can be part of your plan, but you have to see the patient first, you mm-hmm. know, if it's in the differential.
Yeah.
And, but Scarlett with her sigh,
yeah.
The first time I ever met her, she was covering for Vinoda. Vinoda was my chief at Jacoby, and Scarlett came in. I don't know why Vinoda wasn't there one day. So she comes in, and this patient comes into triage with 200s over 130s. And I was freaking out, you know, and she just comes in and very like nonchalantly is like, La Bedlo, Meg, labs, you know, it was just like all very straightforward. And I just looked at her and it was like, I fell in love. Love at first sight. Wait, who are you and how can I learn to be like you?
Yeah. Melissa, I want to say one more thing. My last time ever delivering a baby, and I knew it was going to be the last time, I came on call that night because I was leaving Montefiore and I wasn't going to do deliveries anymore. I came on call with this attitude like, I am going to give my all. I am going to give my all to these patients. Anyway, the patient I had, I walked in the room and she's like, please spell your full name so I can write it down in case I want to sue you. So that's how it started. And then, you know, it was like a long protracted labor. Eventually she needed a C-section and I was doing her C-section at whatever time, early in the morning. And then you came and you're like, I'm going to, like the baby was out and we were closing and you're like, I'm here, you can go. And I was like, no. This is my last patient. And she was very obese and her abdomen was really deep and I was not sure that she wasn't bleeding. And I was just like, can we close? And you were there and you helped me. And I felt so grateful that you were there and you were looking inside and you're like, it's okay. She's good. And then I was like, okay, fine. And then you took it out, you know, you took care of her, but I was like, Melissa, I don't want anything to happen to her. Like nothing can happen to her. She's just like, you know, and you took her over and thank goodness. She was really funny when I went to go see her. I went to go see her when I was leaving. The baby was already in a fully matching outfit. The baby was on Instagram already. And she had hidden like a bucket of like chicken in her bag and she's already eating it at like 7 o'clock in the morning. She's like, I have not eaten in 2 days. I'll never forget her, but it was cool to hand her off to you.
Well, things come full circle because you taught me.
Yeah,
I knew. It is interesting because, you know, when I first decided to do the podcast, you know, I was like sort of thinking of who to come on and who would be really fun to talk to. And obviously all the people that I love dearly. And I was also, you know, a lot of the guys came up in my mind that they'd just be entertaining. Right. And then as far as people offering to do it, more of the men offered than the women, which was sort of interesting. And so I felt really bad because the first two podcasts are men. And I was like, you know, this is a primarily female field.
definitely.
I was really shocked by the group text and how many of them felt like it sounded like a discomfort with the process, not just that they were busy. And I was like, oh, okay, that's strange.
Yeah, no, more women are timid. I think they're concerned maybe about how it might affect their career, whatever they might say. But, you know, I don't want this to be that type of podcast. And certainly, I don't think we said anything that we should be ashamed of today.
I'd say we were all ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, I was motivated by thinking it would be nice to document that piece of our lives. And I remember it so fondly. I love you both. So even though I have no time for this and, you know, whatever, but I was just like, I think that's really special, you know, like to highlight a sliver of life, a very important one.
Well, yeah. Like nailing you down tomorrow is maybe the feat of the century.
I know. You were like 9:30 on Saturday. And I was like, my husband's out of town. I'm there. Post Shabbos. Let's do this.
I have children and dogs like all around me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm so grateful for you both, obviously, for coming, and this is where I'm going to get a little sappy. But, you know, the impression that you guys made on me is so lasting. All right, guys. Well, thank
you. This was fun. It was nice to chat with you guys.
Thank you so much. Until next time on Pearls of Wisdom. Smarter. Thanks for making me